No, you'd get arrested for that in this building.
So, are there issues here?
Hey, good morning. We're going to open the meeting for the House Interim Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources on Thursday, January 11th, 2018. And I first of all want to thank welcome our Representative Boehm, who is sitting at the dais with us today and is going to be representing the, you want to describe this? Which area you represent?
I represent District 59 from West Wasco County, Jefferson County, Wheeler County, and Northern Deschutes County.
So welcome and thank you very much for joining us today. We have our chair, Rep. Clem, who's traveling on business and is unable to be with us here today. And so we are going to carry on without him and give him good reports when he gets back. And so what we would like to start with today is the 2017 fire season update. And we really appreciate everybody who has helped us make this possible. We've invited ODF and USFS to come back to the committee for a continuation of the 2017 fire season update from the November legislative days. And this plan is to hear a brief recap from the departments to refresh our memories on the key points that we are using in the majority of the hour for questions that we didn't have time for last time. And so we really want both our dais to really take advantage of being able to ask our experts about this fire season update. So at this time, I'd like to invite Peter, Ron, and Tracy up. And I'm going to please ask you to run the panel as you see fit. And please introduce yourself as you are giving any remarks before we start on any kind of questioning. Thank you.
Good morning, Vice Chair McLean and members of the committee. I am Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Oregon State Forester and Director of the Department of Forestry. And as Vice Chair McLean said, we'll be providing an update on the fire season. So to start with, Happy New Year.
Thank you.
The 2017 fire season is now completely over. While we ended the year with an extremely long, challenging fire season, made even longer by the catastrophic fires in Southern California, we once again stepped up and did a great job. I want to give kudos to all our folks and retirees, with a special nod to our folks who went to sunny California in December. They risked missing Christmas on the Thomas Fire, but we did get most of them back the day before. A few ended up staying over through Christmas. Oregon's policy directs us to preserve and conserve forest resources through prevention and suppression of forest fires using a complete and coordinated system. Oregon's policy also states that the system's primary purpose is protecting forest resources, second only to saving lives. We have a simple, clear fire mission, providing aggressive, safe initial attack to stop fires at their smallest size, minimizing acres burned, suppression cost, and resource loss. And I thank the legislature for providing that clarity in our statutes. But once again, our department was pushed to its limits fighting this summer's wildfires. We were in an all-hands-deck mode for most of the season. But our complete and coordinated system proved its worth again this fire season. In particular, our landowner and operator, contractors, and severity resources were critical to success. But we could not have done it without the help of all of our partners, including the state fire marshals, National Guard, state police, our federal partners, including the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, local, county, and city leaders, emergency responders, and many other states and international partners. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ron Graham for a brief reminder of the 2017 fire season and then give some closing comments.
Good morning, Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Graham, and I'm serving as the Interim Chief of the Fire Protection Division, Oregon Department of Forestry. I want to give you a brief, very brief recap on the report out that we gave during the November legislative days on the extent of the 2017 fire season. And if you recall, we mentioned that the 2017 fire season was above average on all accounts by the measures that we track as far as acres burned, number of fires, and the cost. I would also ask that you kind of look at the map as I speak, as I will reference it a few times. So year to date, and of course our numbers aren't 100% final yet, they will likely change very slightly, and the numbers have only changed slightly since we spoke to you in November. Year to date, we've had 1,079 fires on ODF protected lands. That is a little over 100 fires over our rolling 10-year average at this time. Also, we have burned 47,587 acres year to date. That is up significantly again over our rolling 10-year average, which is around 33,000 acres burned on ODF protection. You can see by the map, there's some pretty bold distinctions as you look at some of the large fires that occurred. And this is not all of the large fires that occurred in the 2017 fire season, some of the more memorable ones. Of all the fires up there, you'll see two fires that are kind of colored in the gray and white. That is the Flounce Fire, the one further to the bottom, and the Horse Prairie Fire. And those two fires represent the two fires that were 100% ODF protected land jurisdiction. So with that, the rest of those fires are all multi-jurisdiction fires, and that is not an uncommon occurrence. It's often the case in any given fire season that fires involve multiple jurisdictions. With that, I would point out that our cost to date is about $38.9 million, and again, that's almost $5 million over our rolling 10-year average. Mm-hmm. So significant costs, significant number of fires, significant acres burned. Some of the number of fires was due to the increase in lightning. Lightning-caused fires were up about 4% this year. 2016, there was almost no lightning. It was not a significant factor in the number of fires. I've spoke about rolling averages, looking at the 10-year rolling averages, but I wanted to point out when we look at fires on average, breaking it out by decades, it paints a little bit different story on ODF protection. You can clearly see that during the 90s, ODF protection lands, we were burning about 12,000 acres. In the first decade in the 2000s, that doubled, a little bit more than doubled, to over 25,000 acres. And as we sit now in this current decade, we're burning over 40,000 acres on average. And with that, I will turn it back over to State Forester Daugherty for closing comments.
As I said in November, this fire season has reinforced what we already know from the 2016 Secretary of State audit in our fire program review. We do not have a sustainable organization for these kinds of fire seasons. The 2017 fire season marked the fifth out of the last 6 years of extreme fire severity, complexity, and long duration. This summer, we once again had to delay or suspend work in our other divisions as we focused on fire. As is typical every year, ODF is very successful at initial attack. However, we were stretched thin during extended attack fires and were challenged to find resources for our fires, keeping our incident management team staffed and supporting the multiple interagency large fires across Oregon's landscape and our partners on extended attack fires. Frankly, we're an organization built for the average fire season of a decade ago. We need to change if we are going to continue to protect Oregonians, communities, and forests from wildfire. We need to significantly increase the pace and scale of treatments on forest lands to make Oregon's forests more resilient to fires. We need to help communities adapt to increasing fire severity, and we need to ensure our ability to provide an adequate response to fire. ODF is working with our landowner partners, stakeholders, and other agencies on approaches for addressing these issues as we prepare for the upcoming fire seasons. And I thank you, and I'll turn it over to Tracy Beck, the Forest Supervisor of the Willamette National Forest.
Thanks, Peter. And good morning, Vice Chairs McLean and Springer, and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Beck. I'm the Forest Supervisor of the Willamette National Forest in Springfield, Oregon. I'm joined here by Craig Glazier, the assistant assistant director for Fire and Aviation Management for the USDA Forest Service Pacific Northwest Region. We're here today on behalf of Regional Forester Jim Pena, who sends his regrets because that he's unable to be here personally. I'll aim to keep my remarks brief so we can reserve more time for questions. So I'll get through it quick. I want to thank the legislature, governor's office, state office for your active participation and partnership in the management of national forests. We appreciate this opportunity to testify alongside our Oregon Department of Forestry, ODF, partners. The mutual cooperation and assistance we enjoy with ODF, the state fire marshal, municipal fire protection districts, and local government leaders is absolutely essential to the work we do, particularly around wildfire management. We're grateful for the strong and effective relationships we enjoy with our partners here in Oregon and are committed to building on that foundation. The Pacific Northwest region experienced a long and arduous fire season in 2017. We had a wet winter and an early spring. This contributed to new significant new vegetative growth, with extended stretch of hot and dry summer that caused much of the new growth to dry out quickly and become prone to ignition. These conditions led to atypical fire patterns, including an unusual number of high elevation starts on National Forest System lands early in the season that escaped initial attack and spread onto state and private lands on some fires. Despite challenging conditions, our initial attack success rate remains consistent with past years at about 96% to 98%, meaning we catch all but 2% to 4% of the fires when they're small. Here in Oregon, we had over 2,000 fire starts, including 764 that met the criteria for large fire designation, over 100 acres. This affected over 725,000 acres of all types of land ownerships in the state. This included 1,133 fires on over 490,000 acres of National Forest System lands. Many of these fires occurred west of the Cascades. Thousands of Oregonians were impacted by smoke and evacuations. 16 homes were lost and 45 other structures burned. Fortunately, we did not experience any direct loss of life or serious bodily injury. After conducting burned area emergency assessments on fires across the region, we found that 9.5% burned at a high soil severity, 26.2% burned at a moderate severity, and 64.3% burned at a low or very low severity. We were working diligently to capture timber value from these lands and have identified 27.5 million board feet of salvage harvest potential so far, with additional assessment work remaining. We anticipate completing National Environmental Policy Act reviews of all these salvage projects by the end of June 2018. For fiscal year 2017 fire season, the cumulative cost of the Forest Service wildland fire suppression activities once again exceeded funding available. With over 28,000 people supporting firefighting activities during the peak of the season, total Forest Service costs exceeded $2.4 billion nationwide. This once again makes the past year the most expensive to date for fire suppression. The USDA Forest Service spent more than $585 million on fire suppression in Oregon alone. One way we intend to change this trend is by continuing to partner with states, counties, tribes, and other stakeholders to implement the National Cohesive Wildfire Strategy that was developed jointly with these same partners. The strategy's stated purpose is to safely and effectively extinguish fire when needed, use fire where allowable, manage our natural resources, and as a nation, live with wildland fire. The cohesive strategy provides a framework for all of us to work together towards three goals. First, restoring and maintaining landscapes. The second, creating fire adapted communities. And third, improving fire response. This means working together to expedite fuels reduction and other vegetation management projects. to find efficiencies to improve risk assessment and risk management techniques for wildfire response, and to assure there's defensible space around our communities and structures. Oregon has been a national leader in piloting and implementing the cohesive wildfire strategy, receiving over $1.1 million from the Forest Service grant money since 2012 for projects on the Blue Mountains, Deschutes County, and Southwest Oregon. State and local officials here in Oregon have been invaluable partners in each of these endeavors. A few examples of our key cooperative efforts include implementing fuel reduction and forest restoration projects across state and federal boundaries under the Good Neighbor Authority, convening managers for preseason interagency fire simulation and post-fire after-action reviews exercises, and encouraging consideration of wildfire risk in local planning and zoning through the FireWise Communities program. Consistent investment in these programs helps to foster strong, effective intergovernmental relationships, which helps us accomplish more work on the ground to enhance the ecological and economic resilience of Oregon communities. We appreciate this committee's support of the USDA Forest Service's partnership with your state and welcome your questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you. At this time, then, we're going to open it up to questions, and we'd like to recognize Representative Barreto first.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So the increase in the acres burned from 12,000 in the early 90s up to 40,000. So I think the spotted owl issue started around 94. So how much do you attribute to the lack of cutting and management, you know, since then to the acres burned currently, you know? And you mentioned management, and what kind of management do you now recommend, you know, versus what was really happening back then?
Yeah, Vice Chair McLean, Representative Barreto. The numbers we showed in the decadal were just ODF protected lands, and those are generally industrial lands, family forest lands, and then we do have intermixed with BLM. We still have a complete and coordinated system with a very aggressive initial attack. We generally fight fire in very well-roaded areas. So I would attribute most of this to, over those three decades, we've also seen an increase in all our fire statistics that indicate high fire. So energy release component has been consistently going up. Our fire seasons are longer. And so we're just having, when we get lightning, a lot of lightning, we're just having a harder time catching all the fires at initial attack.
And I guess I could enter into that conversation a little bit. Of course, the graphs that you saw were how Peter portrayed them, just ODF protected lands. I'm sure if we did those same graphs on National Forest System lands, they'd look pretty similar. It's the incidence of fire is going up, the fires are getting larger. Speaking from experience in 2017, a lot of the fires on U.S. Forest Service, National Forests, started out in wilderness areas. So there isn't really good access there. We did an initial attack them, but they escaped initial attack. I don't know if Craig has a figure Oregon-wide, but on the Willamette alone, I think the figure was 70% of the acres we burned in 2017 were within designated wilderness. So they weren't in areas outside of the wilderness where we have roads and management activities. That's where we stopped the fires.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, follow-up. So thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned the fire seasons are longer. You know, what do you have that recorded so that back in the 90s you can look at that? And how much longer are they now?
30 to 45 days longer.
what the information, and we have tracked that information. It's generally 30 to 45 days longer fire seasons we're experiencing now than we had back in the early 90s.
One more follow-up.
Yes.
So can you give kind of a start and an end to that, to the fire season month in by month?
Sure. You want me to? Okay. We had our first fires in June. A lot of times on the Willamette, we don't really start to get into a lot of fires and project-sized fires until July. And they went right through early October, and a lot of times we'll have season-ending, you know, in the past, season-ending events mid-September through the end of September.
Thank you.
Representative Salinas.
Thank you. So we all saw the Southern California, Northern California fires, and even here in Oregon, Eagle Creek, the interface with the urban wildlands really concerns me, and I know it concerns others. What kind of investments do we need to make here to make sure we're getting ahead of that?
I'm glad we're not like California, and so our land use laws has limited to a significant amount the amount of interface we do have in Oregon. But that is where we are really challenged, and particularly on the west side, we have a good agreement on the east side for fuels reduction, and on the Millie fire in 2017, we were able to stop that fire as it approached Sisters because of treatments that we did across, you know, all lands, and the fire dropped down and we could take an aggressive initial attack. And you can see that on the map of the fire. It literally stops in a straight line as it approached Sisters. And so treatments in the interface providing defensible spaces. Tracy mentioned places where the fire will drop down and we can do aggressive initial attack, I think are going to be important on the west side as well, on those communities. Those forests are not like the east side forest where you had high frequency, low intensity fire. And so getting an agreement on where those defensible spaces should be and how much treatment will be probably a more challenging discussion among stakeholders to reach the kind of agreement we've gotten on the east side about treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Follow up? Yes, please.
So there have been, and there always is here in Oregon, talk about changing our land use laws, as you first referenced. How would weakening the Oregon land use laws to allow more development in rural areas affect those efforts?
So the things with related to fire only, we see greater, where we have higher housing density in forested areas in rural residential, we have more starts. We have higher expenses. We have the complication of protecting homes as opposed to just fighting wildfire. So fire costs go up. We get increased number of starts. And on the management side, management tends to go down the more housing density you have in those.
Thank you.
Other questions for
us? Could I add something a little bit to that as well? You know, in partnership with ODF, we work with communities and come up with community wildfire protection plans. And then we also use the FireWise program to help the homeowners treat their adjacent lands. And then, you know, there's funding, federal funding, then to treat lands adjacent, you know, to those homeowners then that are public lands. So that's happening throughout Oregon. You know, we have a ways to go. There's just a lot of work to do. And it's not a one and done. You know, vegetation grows back. So you have to keep on it.
And speaking of that, we have over 115 FireWise communities in Oregon. We're one of the top five in the nation in that program for working with communities to help them adapt to fire risk.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Beck, you mentioned the partnership activities that are ongoing in your national forest, and I want to commend you for those partnerships in terms of fuels reduction, smoke management, silvicultural applications aimed at improving federal forest health. I think you have a lot to offer and teach the rest of us. Keeping in mind that partnership, I was talking with senior management from the Department of Agriculture last week, and I was struck by their openness to suggestions that additional resources are needed perhaps on many of our federal forests aimed at those kinds of silvicultural management activities that would help improve forest health. And I'm left with the impression that there may be a window of opportunity here for a delegation from Oregon and other Western states that experienced the conflagration this past summer, and would encourage folks to perhaps be thinking along those lines.
Other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank the panel for being here today, and I appreciate the energy, the effort, and the work that you've done. And I was in a meeting in Coronado, California, and they were thanking. They took a moment to stop and actually thank Oregon for sending 50 trucks and all of the personnel down to help in that last fire. And it was very heartfelt, and you could tell that it had made a difference. So thank you for all the work you do in-state and also for the support that we give out-of-state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, I'm closing the informational meeting on the fire season, and I am opening an informational meeting on the educational capital construction proposals and their incorporations of cross-laminated timber, which is a great title and an exciting new area of economic opportunity. And so we are inviting Tom, Gabby, and Valerie. Is Valerie here today? Okay. So Tom and Gabby, please go ahead at your leisure, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Well, good morning. I think sequence-wise, we're thrown off a little bit by Valerie not being here, but she had an emergency come up, so it's not able to be here today. Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee, I'm Tom Insko. I'm president of Eastern Oregon University. And I'd like to first just thank you for your service, commitment, and dedication to the state. As public servants, that's an important role, obviously, in terms of how our state operates going forward. I'd like to thank you for providing me the opportunity to share with you some information on three important projects at our public universities and their connections to the environment and natural resources. Excuse me. I'm dealing with the cold, too, so if I sound like a frog, I apologize. copies of a briefing document have been provided to you, and I hope you take the time to read through that when you have a chance, because it does provide some additional information that I won't be speaking to today, given the time frame that we have. The three projects that are highlighted are the Science Campus at the University of Oregon, Academic Building 2 at Oregon State University's campus in Bend, and Eastern Oregon University's Mountaineer Physical Activity and Wellness Center Field House. And these represent very important investments in higher education because they're really focused on expanding access and opportunity for students. But that's not what we're here specifically talking about today. Today we're talking about the fact that through thoughtful design criteria that include the use of engineered and advanced wood products, they offer a stimulus to the emerging cross-laminated, or CLT, product market. And to give a little more context to why I'm speaking on this, as some of you know, prior to my appointment as president at Eastern Oregon University, I worked in the wood products industry for 20 years. I'm also currently serving my second term on the Board of Forestry as well. I'm also a native of rural eastern Oregon. So I have and continue to experience firsthand the challenges faced in rural natural resource-based economies, and also see the vast restorative needs we see across our forest landscapes. You just listened to presentations on the wildfire season this past year. Obviously, it impacted the urban areas a little more than traditionally we've seen. But as this committee has heard previously, the wildfire seasons have been significant in this state, and the impacts to human health continue to increase. The impacts to, in particular, our rural communities have been significant. And so with CLT, this material is a potential game changer, when it comes to forest health and management. And it's an emerging product here in the United States, but it's a product that's been used extensively in Europe for in excess of 20 years. Unfortunately, to a certain extent with CLT, and in most cases when you have a product that's early in the development curve of a new product introduction, we are fighting some of the challenges of acceptance of the product, and we've made great strides over the course of the last number of years, but there's more opportunity for us to do that. And so when we, and I'll speak specifically, thank you. I don't know how much that'll help, but I appreciate it.
I'd be careful of what you put in it.
Watch her.
Armed today too. Be careful.
When we thought about scoping up this project, and I'll speak specifically to the field house at Eastern Oregon because I know more about that, but I think it applies across the three projects that are we're speaking about today. Specifically for Eastern Oregon University, we're surrounded by three national forests. Meanwhile, we are also next door to the largest designated wilderness in the state of Oregon. And we also have the deepest canyon in Hell's Canyon in North America. So we have this integration of wild lands, working forests, and natural resource-based economies. And we thought, how can we do more than just meet the educational mission and the student needs at Eastern Oregon University as we do this project? That's where wood came into it. Obviously, my 20 years of experience influenced that to a certain extent. But we thought, how can we integrate and advance wood products into the design so we can provide a direct stimulus and we can actually integrate it into future conversations at the university so that we can educate next generations in terms of some of the challenges we have and have an actual showcase of material and how it can be used. So we see a lot of positive opportunities by integrating this design into our field house. We're going to be housing our physical activity and health lab in our field house. We'll also have our outdoor leadership and recreation program in our field house. And so consequently, it really provides an educational laboratory where they can see wood integrated into that structure and deal with the complexities when you talk about wilderness areas, recreation, and some of the trade-offs that you have when you talk about management challenges across our landscape. So we're excited about that, and we're currently working on and bringing a conference to Eastern Oregon University this April to discuss CLT as well and how CLT may offer an opportunity to really address the forest management needs in rural Oregon, specifically on our federal forests that you heard about today. So with that, I will close, and I will turn it over to the person that you'd probably like to hear from more than me and as student at Oregon State University.
Good morning, Vice Chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Gabby Bangert, and I'm a senior studying liberal studies at OSU Cascades. I'm here to talk about the need for the OSU Cascades expansion and many of the other educational capital building that's happening. I work with the student government on campus as the Director of Legislative Affairs. I am a non-traditional student. OSU Cascades' presence in Bend has given me many opportunities that I never thought I would have had. I was born and raised in Bend. OSU Cascades worked with me coming from the local community college, Central Oregon Community College, to figure out a plan of what I wanted to do, which is teaching. Without the support of OSU Cascades, I would not be the person that I am today. As a student of color, I never had the courage to make my voice heard. OSU Cascades gave me the opportunities to strengthen my voice and fight for a spot at the table. OSU Cascades has done this for many other students on our campus. 67% of our students are from Central Oregon. A third of our students are first generation. Over half our students receive the federal Pell Grant, myself included, indicating that our students are of high financial need. Central Oregon has a booming local economy. I've been working with community leaders who are passionate about OSU Cascades expanding because the community needs a trained workforce. In turn, OSU Cascades has programs to match the community's needs, programs like energy systems engineering, computer science, natural resources, tourism, hospitality, and our up-and-coming program, outdoor products program. With the expansion of the campus, the students of OSU Cascades will be able to continue to learn and grow to support our community. As a regional campus, we are not alone. University of Oregon and Eastern Oregon University are tied to their surrounding communities also. They're supporting their communities through programs that they offer. The projects that are being proposed by these universities will also have impacts that will ripple through the university and out to the community. OSU Cascades and Eastern Oregon University are serving a remote, largely rural region of our state. This part of the state also needs access to higher education if we want prosperity for all. I will be graduating from OSU Cascades with a bundle of knowledges and experience that will make the rest of my path towards being a teacher worth every minute that I spent being on campus. I will not be around for the expansion, but I want to make sure that the students who come after me have access to the same experiences and opportunities that I had. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for being here. Are there questions for our panel today? Yes.
Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you for being here. Tom, you had mentioned that you're fighting the challenges of the acceptance of this product in the CLT. And in the last legislative session, we heard from some folks pushing the CLT, and they had mentioned D.R. Johnson was selling everything that they could produce down there, but I don't know that they gave a number of what they were producing. But coming from the timber industry, I mean, one, you need the supply of the product coming in before you invest in this process. And so you probably know the most about this, and I was just wondering about this process in Oregon, and is part of, I guess, the slowness of it coming around and being accepted, is part of that the supply of the product or of the natural resource?
Yeah, it's multifaceted, and I would say there's the industry is working on all components specifically to supply, and what you bring up there. Part of the reason that I and a partner with our resources are, and Oregon Forest Resources Industry is working to bring a conference to Eastern Oregon and invite both manufacturers, architects, construction contractors, and policymakers, and federal, state, and private landowners, is to begin to discuss these issues more specifically. As you know, there has been a concerted effort for a number of years. The state has invested in the federal forest management initiative through the Oregon Department of Forestry. I've been an advocate for that. And that has helped facilitate a lot of collaborative activity. I would say we're still far from where we want to be on the east side. But there's an opportunity to leverage the investments that have already been made to continue the conversation and talk about how can we begin to rebuild an industry that's been decimated in the state of Oregon. And how does advancements in wood products technology offer new opportunities? And specifically for CLT, because of how it's constructed, and you're missing this because Valerie's not here today, is it actually offers the opportunity to integrate the use of smaller diameter lumber that comes from from smaller diameter timber and also lower grade lumber into the construction of the panel. So consequently, it has the opportunity to begin to change the economics of some of that volume that is significant to forest thinning projects. And hopefully through that, and as we continue to expand pace and scale of restoration work, we get more and more social acceptance as well. But I do think in order to stimulate investment, it's going to take multiple parties coming together and saying, and the federal government being there to support with a level of assurance that we're going to get the supply to support the private investment that would be required.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair McLean. I very much appreciate you being here today. This is an issue that I think is important to a number of us, particularly those of us who come from communities where this industry is just paramount to our economic vitality, and I happen to be one of those. We had a presentation in a prior legislative days that brought in the School of Architecture folks who are working on it and the folks from Oregon State who are doing the technical work on how you get these cross-laminated and mass timber certified. And I'm just very excited about the future of this industry. But I know there is some resistance in design. There are people who are not familiar with it. We need to get that's going to take some effort to make sure that the people who are beginning to look to the future and how we design buildings begin to incorporate these materials. And I'm really delighted that in the public sector, particularly at the university level, there's a building being done now in Springfield that's a parking structure. I mean, we're doing a lot of things, but I think we have another layer of opportunity, and you may not be able to answer this question, but there are a number of schools who have passed bond levies that are now building elementary, middle, and high schools where this is not a topic of conversation. And I guess I'm curious to, you know, you have embraced this because of your background. You come from this industry, and, you know, you wear the hat now in the world of higher ed, so you have an understanding of it. Do you have suggestions as to how we may begin to go to that next step and bring in a whole nother layer of potential use for this material, which is so appropriate for those of us who come from a state that's producing all this wonderful mass timber and cross-laminated timber? Frere's Lumber and, of course, D.R. Yep. Johnson are leading the charge. There will be others.
I could talk about this for days. So,
yeah, and I'd like you to.
So first and foremost, I think from a legislative standpoint, I think all of you have to be very thoughtful about all the policy activities that you're considering and how it could impact this. I don't want to get into it, but there's conversation about emissions associated with drying lumber and wood products, and how does that maybe disincent or incent investment in this sector? Part of what I see as an opportunity, in particular, we're focusing more in rural Oregon versus urban areas, getting is this conference to get the right people coming together and talking about it, because we have the spark. D.R. Johnson, you referenced Frere's Lumber in the state of Washington. We have Vaughan Brothers that is looking at investing. There's another business in the Spokane Valley that is moving forward with investment. And the University of Idaho just last week announced a $45 million project on their campus that is dominated by the use of mass timber and wood products in their design. And so I think we're at the right point of really invigorating that conversation even more. And that's why I like the fact that the universities are stepping into this, and now we can leverage that going forward to bring those people together and break down some of the paradigms. And I'll use one example. The natural knee-jerk from a contractor today in the housing sector, for example, is that the use of this wood product costs more because the product itself does. But the way you construct with this product is significantly different. And so in terms of the workforce you need and the amount of time on the actual site is significantly different. In terms of residential construction, literally they're changing the construction time on the site from, you know, 4 months to a couple of weeks. So if you think about the opportunity in urban populations for residential construction with this material and the potential impact on being able to only be on a site for a couple of weeks, it's a game changer. But it takes time for those that are doing it today to think about how do we adjust our business model and capture the economies that has to offer. I digressed a little bit there. The thing is, we've got to continue to bring the right people together to investigate the options here, and that's what we want to do as universities.
Madam Chair, very brief follow-up. I see an opportunity for those of us on this panel who have been former school board members. Mm-hmm. Oregon School Board Association in November has a conference. This would be a wonderful opportunity to spread this word across the state to the school board association to make sure that superintendents and school board chairs and school board members have an opportunity to begin to absorb this information so that they can have these considerations as they move forward when they're planning to do construction. I'm just delighted, and I may follow up with you. I may ask my superintendent to come to your conference, if I may.
Great. Yes.
If he's willing to make, because they're in the process of designing some buildings, and I would love to make sure that they're thinking broadly about how they spend their very precious dollars. But this may be an opportunity that we don't want to waste. So thank you.
I agree. Thank you. And we'd love to have any attend.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. I've been in the wood products a number of years of my life, and I know how to make plywood. I know how to make lumber. Mm-hmm. I know LVL. I understand that. And I understand truss joists out of Eugene, but you're talking about taking lumber and using it like plywood where you intertwine it?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Really?
Very similar to plywood construction where you're using veneers and doing cross bands.
Cross bands.
Exactly, which adds the structural component to that. Of course, LVL is, they're all parallel laid.
Right.
But you're building
but they're different
panels.
Segments.
Exactly. You're essentially taking lumber and doing crossband and building different depths of panel based on the architectural specifications of, and through that process of building it, you can bury lower grade narrow lumber within that panel and capture the value that generates through that. Very very similar conceptually, if you know plywood and such, to the plywood industry. And actually, Ferris is using, they're going down the pathway of using veneers in a similar way of building mass panels with veneers versus lumber. So I think it's exciting that there are a couple of different alternatives.
Not only would the strength be there, but it also helped the recovery factor on the wood.
Right.
Got it.
That's so resilient.
Thank you very much. Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your presentation and all your work in this area. Not only, well, and I appreciate all the comments because Representative McEwen's correct, as she has the district just north of mine, and we have a lot of similarities. I represent Southwest Oregon, which is a fish farm and forestry, and as a natural resource jobs move away, I really see CLT Mass Timber as the true bridge between the urban and rural divide, because utilizing this technology not only will assist in the natural resource jobs that are needed in our rural communities, that built our rural communities and are meant to sustain them, but also when we debate in this building, carbon and greenhouse gas emissions and carbon sequestration, this is a way that we can actually utilize the best carbon sequester material in the state and sequester it for generations in these type of structures. And so I appreciate all the efforts in this area.
Yeah, and I would just share with the committee, thank you, that I'm by no means an expert on CLT. I wouldn't suggest I am, but both Oregon State University, of course, and the University of Washington are doing a tremendous amount of research in this space. And you talked about carbon sequestration, and mass timber, advanced wood products offer a significant opportunity there. And as we think about the real needs in terms of infrastructure development and think about policies that we put in place to actually allow wood to be used more, it offers an opportunity for our natural resources to play an important role in the climate adaptation discussion that is going on as well. So, again, there's just tremendous, so much space to really talk about how there's a value add for Oregon in this conversation, and quite candidly, the whole Pacific Northwest, given the wonderful landscapes that we enjoy.
Other comments or questions? Yes, Representative Loretta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to publicly thank you, Tom, for leaving the timber industry and coming and serving at the helm of EOU. You have done a fantastic job, and now we see that you really never left the timber industry. It kind of comes full circle, so thank you.
Well, I want to thank the panel. This is an exciting area for more discussion and looking at both the barriers and also the opportunities. And again, Northern California, you didn't mention too much, but I was at a meeting in December where we had one session that was on laminated timber, and they were getting real excited about wanting to partner with Oregon because they feel like we've got, you know, a market opportunity there, again, with supply maybe coming from both areas and being able to really sort of make a West Coast, you know, statement about some of the things that are possible. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to now close the informational meeting on this topic, and we will go on our agenda to opening an informational meeting on what we're going to consider looking at some LCs that we've been working on, the chair has been working on with folks, and we're going to start out with looking at LC 103, which is industrial hemp. And I believe Representative Wilson, you have a crew of folks that you've invited to come, so why don't you bring your panel. And I believe there's also a member from Oregon State University who's an addition to that, so please come forward. We've set aside about 15 minutes, but we are ahead of schedule, so feel free to, you know, ask questions and make sure we have a full understanding of what this LC is about.
Thank you, Acting Chair McLean, Vice Chair Sprenger, and members of the committee. Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass. Well, thank you for entertaining us today. It is a pleasure to bring this topic back before you. You're not strangers to this. You've had an opportunity to study industrial hemp before, and you've been very gracious to us in the past, demonstrating the fact that you appreciate this product for what it is and what it can do. Like timber, it is an ancient product, but in many ways it's new for us as it enjoys a rebirth here in the state of Oregon. Just a little bit about LC 103. It reflects our efforts to perfect industrial hemp law in Oregon. The word is perfect. It is a continued effort to come into full compliance with the 2014 federal farm bill. So we're attempting to get it right as we possibly can. We're really proud of the progress that we've made so far, and we're very proud of the farmers who have put it on the line to grow industrial hemp. Courtney Moran will tell us a little more in a bit about how many people are actually doing this, adding to the economy of to Oregon, and especially rural Oregon. As we move ahead, we continue to work with the interested stakeholders. We're absolutely thrilled to have OSU with us. They're going to be extremely important in this whole process. And we have many other stakeholders, all who have something to say about this product and are attempting, like we are, to make the bill better and more resilient. So we're excited about it. And again, I want to thank you for your past efforts, because you have looked into this and you've done good things on this subject before, and we look forward to that once again. So with that said, I'd like to turn it over to Courtney Moran.
Good morning, Acting Chair McLean, Vice Chair Sprenger, members of the committee. I am Courtney Moran. I am a cannabis attorney with my firm Earthlaw LLC, and I'm also an industrial hemp lobbyist for the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association. Thank you all for having us today and giving us this opportunity to provide a little preview of our industrial hemp bill that we're going to have for this upcoming session. As Representative Wilson mentioned, our progress, Oregon has become a leader in industrial hemp production over the past several years. In 2015, we only had 9 farmers engaged in our program. In 2016, we had 77 farmers, and in 2017, we had 233 farmers registered with the State Department of Agriculture. We have become one of the top 3 leading producers in the country, and I am very grateful for all of you for helping make that a reality. As such, we want to continue to allow this industry to thrive and allow all of our program participants to thrive. And as such, the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association has been collaborating for the past year and a half with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Justice, the Oregon Farm Bureau, Oregon State University, and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The majority of the text in LC 103 is a reiteration of House Bill 2371, which did pass unanimously out of this committee last session. We have made a few additions to the language that have included some additional authority for the OLCC. So as Carl mentioned, we are really trying to make sure that our program is in line with the federal farm bill. And what we need to do to make sure that is the case is renaming our program to an agricultural pilot program. And that will bring us completely in line with the language of the 2014 Agricultural Act. Also, we are creating the authority for Oregon State University to engage in a certified seed program. Dr. Noller will be giving more clarifications about that, but as an industry, we are very excited to have OSU at the table and finally engage with research here in our state. We have also added some additional rulemaking authority for both the Department of Agriculture as well as the OLCC, and the OLCC regulatory authority will be applied only to when hemp is on their licensed premises, but the Department of Agriculture will be a rulemaking authority over the general program. In regards to the OLCC authority, we are clarifying in the statute the right for Oregon industrial hemp growers and farm and handlers to make sales and transfers into the OLCC system that will require complete compliance with OLCC rules, including mandatory testing and tracking of anything that is brought onto these licensed premises throughout that license system. We have also established that if and when federal law changes and increases the THC concentration for the definition of industrial hemp, that will apply to Oregon law, so we won't have to come back to you just to make a change in that definition. And we also have provided authority to create an industrial hemp fund, distinct from the general fund, which is for the registration and other program fees that are already generated by the department, but to have our funds separate. Thank you.
Very much. Sir.
Acting Chair McLean, Vice Chair Springer and committee. My name is Dr. Jay Noller. I'm a professor and department head of crop and soil science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. I wish to read a position statement for Oregon State University on LC 103 relating to industrial hemp. Oregon State University supports LC 103, the industrial hemp bill. This bill significantly improves the university's ability to conduct its federally authorized pilot research program on industrial hemp. This legislative concept and bill provide a greater alignment of state statutes with the federal farm bill of 2014. Provides access to the best productive varieties of industrial hemp seed from around the world, and provides authorization for OSU to certify industrial hemp seeds produced in the state. Under existing state law, specifically Section 7, Chapter 71 of Oregon Laws 2016, OSU has had no success in the importation of industrial hemp seeds from foreign sources because of the provisions of this section. Seed suppliers read this section as stripping them of their intellectual property rights on their variety of industrial hemp, grown to seed in Oregon. LC 103 removes this impediment and enables OSU to gain access to foreign industrial hemp seed for its pilot research program. Again, it's all about research. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for our panel today? Yes, please. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Note that in your testimonies you have mentioned, and I think Ms. Moran was the one that focused on it, the involvement of OLCC in this arena when, in fact, we're talking about industrial hemp and presumably no intoxicating possibilities here in growing that crop. It seems that we've been overly cautious in involving folks that I don't understand why we necessarily need to involve them, and it seems like it could be a waste of resources and taxpayer money with these kinds of involvements. I'm just wondering, would it be possible to genetically modify the plant or the seeds such that we can assure everyone that there is no THC or any other kind of drugs that are being grown by this crop and eliminate what appears to be an overly regulated system?
Yes, thank you for your question, Representative Witt. The reason that we're bringing OLCC in is because several members of the industry want to have access to the processing facilities that the OLCC industry has developed, or the recreational market has developed. And several folks of the general consumer marketplace are familiar purchasing cannabis products, whether they are intoxicating or non-intoxicating industrial hemp products, in dispensaries. And so we want to clarify that the hemp growers and hemp handlers have access to those processors and to those retailers. But I absolutely agree with you that we don't need additional oversight or additional regulation, and that's why any authority for OLCC is limited to anything on their licensed premises. And anything, you know, derived from industrial hemp should technically not be intoxicating, and through processing, any intoxicants can be removed.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Other questions for our panel? I want to thank you for being here today, and I appreciate you taking the time to update us on what some of the new issues are on this subject, and we'll be hearing more about this, I'm sure, during our committee meetings when session opens. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to close the informational meeting on LC 103. And we're going to go down on our agenda to a discussion of the 2018 legislative concepts, because Representative Helm is not here yet for LC 147. And so at this time, I would like to indicate to you that there are some bills that are on the list for committee bills, but there are also some of you who have bills out there that you may want to share some information on if they are part of this committee's agenda. So I'd like to offer the opportunity for anyone who wants to share a bill concept or something that they believe will be affecting this work of this committee during session. Does anybody have one? Yes, sir.
Thanks, Vice Chair McLean. So I'm getting this right, so I'm getting used to this stuff. I have a bill concept that expands the Good Neighbor Authority, tries to dedicate some lottery funds to put a head on the horse to identify metrics that we could start to achieve to get to work in our forest, and then utilize timber sales to make that program self-sustaining so that the legislature should no longer need to fund it.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Any questions? You can ask questions or give comments or give advice to our new member, whatever you'd like. So anybody else? Any LCs that you want to share? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have one, and I'm not sure that it will come to this committee or revenue, but it has to do with the proportionment of compensation for for wolf depredation. So as wolf numbers increase, that compensation number increases also, and at least have a baseline that we can go on from the last legislative session as wolf numbers increase through the years.
Okay. Thank you. Questions or comments? Okay, at this time then, I think what I'm going to ask is I'm going to close that part of the meeting, so that informational part of possible concepts is closed. And what we're going to do now is we're going to go to the introduction of the committee concepts. And I'm going to ask our staff, who has prepared a paragraph on each one of these concepts that our chair has been working on as far as talking to people and possible committee bills. And so she will give us a description, and this is also on OLIS. But you're welcome to ask any questions that we might be able to answer.
Okay, Vice Chair McLean and committee members, LC 49 would prohibit bridge construction on the Deschutes River within certain segments of the Deschutes Scenic Waterway. It directs the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department to study and make recommendations to the Legislative Assembly by September 15th of 2019 on recreational trail routes connecting Bend and Sund River. It directs the OPRD to study three additional rivers each biennium and submit biennial reports to the governor recommending designation of additional rivers or river segments as scenic waterways when appropriate, and requires OPRD to submit an initial report no later than September 15th, 2020.
Okay. Any questions on that one? We have heard this, we've heard this topic before last year. Okay.
I believe this is Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think this is expanded.
Yes.
This is a much larger bill than the
yes.
bill that came last year. So
that's
I think
true.
We'll be taking a good, significant, hard look at it. Thank you.
And also talks about relationships between local and state agencies. And there's a lot of some consulting. And
there's a lot in here.
There's a lot in there. Yes.
Vice Chair McLean and committee members, LC 147 would allow courts to impose a misdemeanor fine or a compensatory fine not exceeding the damages listed under the wildlife law violations. In addition, incarceration if a person is convicted of misdemeanor for unlawful taking or killing of wildlife after January 1st of 2019. It requires compensatory fines be made payable to Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. It reduces the amount recoverable as damages for the offense by the amount of a compensatory fine imposed, and prohibits a person from obtaining a license tag or permit if a compensatory fine has not been paid. And this is the LC that Representative Helm is on the way to speak about.
And he just arrived. So I think what we'll do is have you go ahead and just give the next paragraph on the other committee concept, and then we will hold off on any motions and we'll ask Representative Helm to come up and share some information about that concept.
Okay, Vice Chair McLean and committee members, LC 216 is the final committee concept. It allows small-scale recreation communities established in conjunction with a transfer of development opportunity, or TDO, to be sited on land that is both planned and zoned for forest use and rural and not subject to statewide land use planning goals. It allows county approval of application for small-scale recreation community to constitute an acknowledged exception to applicable statewide planning goals with which the use would not otherwise comply. It requires small-scale recreation community applicants to demonstrate to the county that adequate streets, utilities, and services are available and will be made available prior to occupancy. Reduces required minimum distance between urban growth boundary of a large city and the urban growth boundary of selected cities for that economic development pilot program from 100 miles to 78 air miles. Mm. It corrects an erroneous cross-reference in statute and declares emergency effective on passage.
And we do have LCDC here today in case there are some other questions that we can't answer. So we'll be happy to try and...
This is just submitting them as
yeah.
possibilities.
Yes,
right.
They are. And so this
after.
Is not a debate on these issues. This is just for information only. And I probably should read this before Ken comes up. Please remember, I just want to remind committee members that if you're voting on these concepts, that is in no way indicating support or opposition to the bills. This is really just a process item to get the bills into the process so we can discuss them as needed in the February session. Okay.
So you don't want my motion now?
Do you want to go ahead and just do the motion, or do you want to hear from Ken first? Representative?
Madam Chair, could we have some more explanation on the last LC concept? that you described. What is it that we are trying to achieve or accomplish by that?
Can I ask LCDC to come up here, please, representatives of LCDC? Because, first of all, this is something that our chair has been working on, and I think she can answer those questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
Good morning, Chair McLean, members of the committee. The LC 216 is being Oh, I'm sorry, for the record. Thank you. My name is Ellen Miller. I am the legislative coordinator with DLCD. I'm not an LCDC member, but I'm the legislative coordinator with DLCD. The legislative concept was submitted as a technical fix bill to fix two pieces of legislation that were passed in 2017. The first of which is the what we call the Metolius TDO, or the Metolius Transfer Development Opportunity Bill, which was House Bill 2031 that this committee heard during last session. The other bill is House Bill 2743, which we refer to as the Airport Pilot UGB Expansion Bill. So all of the elements that Laura so clearly defined, those are all technical fixes so that those parties that passed those bills in 2017 can implement those plans.
So other questions? Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair McLean. Can you define for me a recreational, what are we talking, where did it go? Recreational development community, whatever.
So this, Representative Chair McLean.
What is it?
Representative McEwen. Sorry, I'm a little dusty. I got to remember this, how to do this. The small-scale recreational community is defined in statute, and it was defined for the purposes of this Metolius TDO. So there is very specific criteria that this small-scale recreational community must meet, meaning the acreage and the density of the units and different facilities that are a part of it.
So this is very specific to one entity, which is...
Chair McLean, Representative McEwen, absolutely,
it is
very specific to not only just one TDO, Transfer Development Opportunity, but also specific to a site that they're looking at siting on.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for the impromptu help.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate that. So at this time, before we go to the motion, I think we're going to ask Representative Helm to come up, and you may have had some others that you're bringing with you, so please bring your panel. And do I have to close this again? So is it okay? Okay. I'm going to close the work session for a moment so we can have an informational session. And so now we're going to go back up on the agenda. And now we are talking about, in an informational setting, LC-147. And we're looking to Representative Helm to start us off.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ken Helm, House Representative for District 34. And I want to express my appreciation to the chair, even though he's absent today, in considering this bill as a committee bill. I wanted to give you a little bit of history because most of you on the committee were here when we started this work in 2016. And just to remind you, in 2016, Representative Witt and Representative Krieger and myself brought you a bill that attempted to update our poaching laws and our wildlife violations. This committee looked at that bill very carefully, and as part of that, we updated the fines, the compensatory damages that we wanted judges to impose. Once the judge had determined that a criminal violation had occurred, we said, if that part is done, we want you to impose the following penalties. And the reason was, we really wanted to get tough on these poachers and make them really think about their pocketbooks when they went out to violate our game laws. And some of those fines were increased substantially. This committee acted on what was then House Bill 4046, agreed that we wanted to get tough on poachers, passed out of the committee 7-2. That bill in 2016 went to the House floor and passed 53-5 and became law later that year. So far, so good. Those laws became effective at the beginning of 2017. The judges started acknowledging them and using them. We were in session when a Court of Appeals opinion came out on May 24th, 2017, called State of Oregon versus Shockey, in which the Court of Appeals determined that it wasn't the fines that were in question in that case, but the methodology by which the government had been bringing claims against poachers did not allow a sufficient connection between the restitution statutes that the counties and the DAs operated under and the fines that we established in House Bill 4046. That was language that we didn't touch. That was historical language from the statute that tries to connect the penalties in the fish and wildlife laws with the way that the courts operate in assessing criminal fines. I tried in concert with Representative Witt and others to get a quick fix in front of us before we finished up in 2017. We had the bill in hand. I was able to get it to rules in time. We had essentially a finished product at that time, but the Rules Committee couldn't quite find time to process it. So we had, I felt at the time, a bill that worked for the Department of Justice, and for our own legislative council, but we just didn't have time to finish it up. So that's where we are today. This is just a bill to stitch together the way that courts can utilize the fines we agreed should be levied on convicted poachers. And I appreciate the committee's willingness to take this up. It gets us back to where we thought we were going to be in 2016 and putting the screws to these folks that are taking our fish and wildlife. And I'm here with Shannon Hearn from our Department of Fish and Wildlife to answer any technical questions about how this will work as we pursue these folks through the courts. Okay.
Questions for our panel? Okay. I think you explained it well enough that we understand what we've got in front of us, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and committee members.
At this time, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the LC 147, and now we are going to open again the work session on the introduction of committee concepts. And at this time, I would like to ask for a motion.
Chair McLean, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 49, dated January 10th, 2018, LC 147, dated January 10th, 2018, LC 216, dated January 5th, 2018.
Representative Springer has moved LC 49, dated January 10th, 2018, LC 147, dated January 10th, 2018, and LC 216, dated January 5th, 2018. That they be introduced as our committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection on these measures, they'll be introduced as our committee bills. And thank you very much for us getting through that. Appreciate it. How much do you want me? So at this time, we're closing the work session. That was what that was all about. Okay, and is there anything else for the good of the order?
I think so.
Yes, please.
Did you have something you wanted to say, Representative Esquivel?
I thought
there was a reason why I brought this.
Waiting for you.
So, I'll show this off. I'll keep it in the box. It intimidates people less. Actually, I'm not going to keep it in the box. So this is a knife that the Oregon Sportsman's Caucus
You look frightened.
No, I'm scared you're going to cut yourself.
I'm sure he has his.
I only cut myself on major holidays when I'm cooking. So in October, when we were at the National Sportsman's Caucus, and I'll remind you that your Oregon co-chairs on the House side are Representative Witt and Representative Esquivel. And Representative Esquivel is a founding member of the Oregon Sportsman's Caucus. We were presented with this, and I'll read it to you, the 2017 NASC Heritage Award Oregon Legislative Sportsman's Caucus Western Region. So west of the Mississippi, Oregon's caucus was acknowledged for the work that we've done. We have the only paid staffer. We fundraise for that in the nation. And this knife is, like, really super cool. You'll need to take a look at it. It was presented to us by C.J. Buck, the grandson of the founder of Buck Knives, on the 75th anniversary of the founding of Buck Knives.
Very cool.
Do you have something to add, guys?
I'd like to follow up a little bit with that, that Oregon has been the icon in the United States for the best and the most well-run caucus in the United States. In fact, Representative Witt and I have given demonstrations and talks on how to run your caucus and how to keep it going and how to make it a better caucus.
Just use a bigger knife.
Yeah. And then she came in with a knife and she took over. So, but, I mean, it's a real privilege to get this award.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that this morning. I appreciate that, and congratulations. That's wonderful. Any other items for the good of the order?
You want to see my knife?
So at that point, I'm going to conclude the meeting for today, and please report back to the chair that we got through it fine, okay? Thank you very much.
I'm not going to give her a
bad
time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
You can shave it.